Welcome back to the Generation Varied podcast. This is the podcast where we discuss culture, health, geopolitics, sports, and everything in between. I am your host, Caleb Norris, and I am joined by my two co-hosts, Ben Okenge and Jack Widener, with our wonderful producer, Sophie St. Furman, behind the scenes. To kick us off here, y'all, this past week we switched over and we sprung forward with daylight savings. How's everybody doing with that transition, y'all?
Oh, man. Honestly, my sleep schedule has kind of been messed up. Sleep is something that's super important to me. So even just a little shift of 1 hour lost like that can do a lot for me. And then also, I'm just not a fan of spring forward in general because I'm an early bird. So I like waking up and having the sun rise, you know, around the time that I wake up. And with this spring forward, it's like, come on, now I just get an extra hour of darkness in my day.
I think for me, this year was a little different because I missed a flight. And I decided to stay up the night before. They rebooked me for the 5 a.m. the next day. And so I had to get an airport at 3 a.m. So I just decided to stay up the whole night, and I did with my roommate, and then we were playing games. Next thing you know, it was time to leave. And I was like, wow, that was the easiest thing ever. Turns out, we lost an hour. Like, yeah. I was like, oh, okay, that's what happened. I'm in Central Time too, so like, I feel like my time zone's all messed up. But definitely start off a wrong step, so hopefully you'll go be better as the week goes.
Yeah, I'm convinced that we're past it as a society. Like, we don't need to keep doing this, y'all. We really don't. So I've been against it, but on the flip side, I'm also a morning person, and so Ben, it's like in the fall, I want that extra hour of sunlight earlier. So I'm a little mixed on it, but yeah, oh gosh, I wish we didn't have another question to ask, because I said I'm mixed on it. We could have just transitioned immediately. But anyways, Ben, just as a follow-up from our last episode, Ben, I have it on good authority that you actually watched the first Dune.
Yes. Yeah, so finally. I did it on my own terms, so I'm okay with it. But few nights ago, Abigail, my wife, and I watched Dune for the first time. It was both of our first time watching it. And I totally understand the way you were talking about it now, Caleb. My thoughts were the visuals were incredible. I love a futuristic feeling movie, and the whole vibe of it is just like kind of mysterious. You want to figure out what's going on. So I loved that. But then at the same time, I felt like you guys said, it's hard to understand. And I'm concerned because now I want to watch the second one, but I feel like I still don't even really understand what happened in the first one. And I don't know. To me, it kind of, you know, I'm not the best writer. I don't write movies, but I kind of get a feeling that it was poorly written because none of what was actually going on in the movie was super hard to understand. Just the way that it was presented made it hard to understand. And I just feel like there's so many ways that it could have been more clear to the viewer.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my thoughts about it. But all in all, I really liked it.
I'm excited that you watched it. So, and can't wait. Wait, Kayla, have you seen the part two?
I haven't yet.
Oh,
no.
You too. Come on. This weekend, you guys got to go to theater.
I'm supposed to see it in IMAX on Sunday with my roommates, so that's our plan, is to go see it like the matinee, so I'm excited for that. But I'll say this, everything in Dune makes sense to me, except for the spirituality of all of it. Like, the Bene Gesserits, whatever, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, that storyline is just so abstract, and it's like, why y'all beating up on his mama? Like what is going on? Like, that don't make no sense to me.
Yeah, I didn't really get that. Are they like nuns? Are with superpowers?
Find out. Y'all gotta find out.
We'll find out, apparently.
Just watch the movie.
But speaking of finding out, y'all, there has recently been a disturbance in the biracial force around the world because because of a recent slam poet whose work has gone viral on TikTok. Now, if you heard my last sentence and you know me at all, you know how I feel about slam poetry. Okay? Her name is Maya Osborne. We're not sending any hate to her or anything like that. But we're going to actually have Ben and Jack here blind react to just a quick 60 seconds of some of her poetry, specifically from her most famous piece, Confessions of a Quadroon. And I'm really excited for you guys to watch this here. So let me get this queued up because this is gonna be my favorite thing. Okay, let me see. Let me screen share. Okay, when I get your guys' blind reaction, we're only gonna watch about 60 seconds.
Hey, keep clapping. Keep clapping. Bring Maya Osborne back to the stage. Keep clapping. Keep clapping. Keep clapping. She makes her way up here.
I'm a quadroon. Now, it's possible that these words and my story are coming at you too soon, and maybe I should wait until that Obama is a mulatto, that's the one-drop rule shit, fades through the American conscience. And maybe my story is just a little too honest.
I'm Mark Osborne, Maya's dad. We actually had a nickname for her, the Amazing Maya. That nickname, I don't know, maybe she was a couple years old, probably came out. I still think it applies more than ever now.
A little too harsh a reminder of civil rights' false promises. A little too bright is the light in my skin that sheds light upon what lactification trauma is. These are the confessions of a quadroon.
Confessions of a Quadroon is absolutely my most well-known piece of work. Am I most requested by family and friends?
Someone who is 3/4 Massa and 1/4 Coon. Someone who changes colors based on the racial makeup of the room.
Which is beautiful because...
Okay, that's enough. We've seen enough.
Wow. Who knew that being biracial was such a conundrum?
Let me tell you something. There has been a disturbance in the force, and I say this as a proud, you know, biracial, as a proud light skin. The light skins are out of control, all right? Absolutely, unequivocally out of control, okay? And this is the source and the root of the unleashing of this disturbance. But I want to start off and talk a little bit today about biracial identity and this specific think piece and all this kind of stuff. But to kick us off here, Ben and Jack, can you share a little bit about your ethnic background?
Hold on. I'm still like reacting. I'm still like trying to gather.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm just trying to gather.
Like, so yeah, I had no idea what I was about to see. And I feel like it's going to take me a little bit to gather my thoughts about that video, but thanks for sharing that. That's definitely a faith meeting. We'll go back to watch the rest of the video.
I need to see the whole thing.
But based off of what you guys have seen, Ben, you shared that it's a lot of feelings, and I agree.
Oh, yeah, it is. You know, I've heard people joke around about, like, bring back bullying, and, you know, I'm not a fan of bullying. Let me just get that straight. But at the same time, I feel like mixed people, we've had it too easy like, if these are the struggles of your life, you got to go through some stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
So Jack, so tell us about your ethnic background.
My dad is from Iowa. He's Caucasian. He's from a rural town, traditional town. Has like a town square, you know, homecoming, surrounded by cornfields. My mom's from the south part of the island called Taidong. She's part of one of the tribes called Puyuma. So my ethnicity background is Taiwanese American. Most of the time when you see Asians and Western, like Caucasian mix, you kind of go by the name of Hapa. There's many celebrities that are like are Hapa, like half Asian, half American, or half just European or whatnot. So, but that's my ethnicity background.
Yeah. And I, my dad is from Rwanda. He is as African as it gets. He's very much the stereotypical African dad. And my mom is from Canada and she's white. And so that mix really built who I am. And I would say that those two elements definitely come together completely in me. But one thing I will say though is like when I was growing up, I didn't know that I was mixed. You know, like when you're a little kid and you're not really aware of like ethnicity and race and those kinds of things. Like I have half siblings that are all older than me and they're all black. And so when I was a little kid, I thought I was black just like them. And I probably made it until like probably second or third grade before I really figured out like, wait a minute, I'm white too. I'm just as white as I am black. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's actually one of the interesting dynamics that we've got on this podcast that we haven't talked much about, the fact that all of us are mixed ethnicities.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. So I guess follow-up question for both of you guys. Do you identify as biracial versus, like for you, Ben, do you identify more as like black or African, or do you identify as biracial? And Jack, for you, do you identify more as Taiwanese versus biracial?
Yeah, for me, I definitely identify as biracial. Whenever I got a do the little standardized test checking of boxes, I will select both black and white. Unless that's not an option to select multiple, in which case I'll just put other, because honestly, to me, it doesn't feel right to say black. And especially here in America, when like being black is generally seen as being Black American, and that's not my background. Yeah. Like the black side of me is very much African, so the cultural experience is very different. But yeah,
I would say for me at least, there is way more cultural differences between being grab and you know, half Asian and half American. Like you see it from the way I experience from the way we eat food, the way when it comes to family relationships, even just mannerism. Like there is a huge contrast between being Asian and being American. And I grew up always just in the middle, just kind of like too Asian for American or too American for Asian, you know. Mm-hmm. That Wonderful Production has this YouTube video, they call it the in-betweeners. Basically, you're living in the space between two cultural ethnicity background, and you kind of just live in that. So I never really considered myself biracial, just because I never really talked about it. I wasn't around a lot of people who were biracial growing up in Taiwan. And it's only like when I went to international school, that's when I'm like, okay, like I am like what it means to me, and how does that, I guess, like my identity, like my cultural identity, like what does that mean to me and who I am today? How does that inform my worldview and whatnot? So it's not like a straight answer like what Ben's like. It's more complex.
Yeah. I think for myself, I do identify as black, and I think it's primarily because the world interacts with me as if I'm a black male. The world does not interact with me as if I'm, you know, biracial or as if I'm white at all. So I'm 6'2", I weigh about 200 pounds. And so the world, and I say that because, and also I don't have, I wouldn't say that I have like white features or European features. And so the world interacts with me as if I'm a black male. So that's really how I identify, and it's how I've identified, I think, since college. And really, I think college is when I started trying to figure and sort this stuff out. So what had happened was is that I was super into ethnicity and culture after I was working in the intercultural office with all of the different cultural groups that we have on campus. And I wrote this article. I don't know if you guys remember it, but I wrote an article for the newspaper called White But Not Quite. And at the time, I thought it was like super woke. And I was like, yeah, this gonna ruffle feathers. Like, I'm out here like telling these people how I feel. And especially because this is like social justice warrior Caleb, just like, yeah, like I'm gonna speak the truth no matter what, similar to, you know, this Maya Osborne. Okay. And I wrote this article called White But Not Quite, and I was like, oh, I can't wait for folk to just hate it. And it was met with so much like applause and approval. And this is gonna sound really bad, but specifically, there was somebody that historically on campus had really bad takes about everything. And they came up to me, Jack, and they said, hey, Caleb, absolutely loved the article. Loved your perspective. So accurate. And when they came up to me and said that, I said, damn, I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board on that one, because if they agree with what I put in there, then I know I'm off, because they don't have a good opinion that I've heard thus far. So I started really sort of studying it and trying to have a better understanding, of sort of, you know, how we come to our own identity of ourselves. So a question that I would love to, you know, ask you guys is, do you guys understand, at least in the American context, sort of the history behind colorism as we would say it? Colorism is a word that I think, especially as it relates to like biracial discourse, like we can't not talk about colorism when we're talking about that. So when I say colorism, does that make sense to you guys as to like what I'm saying? What's your definition of colorism?
Yeah, it does make sense. I think from what I understand, it just has to do with the fact of how people within certain ethnic groups can be treated differently based on like the range of their skin tone. For example, my younger brother, he's, you know, we have both of the same parents, he's a lot more light skinned than me. And so I guess that would just have to do with like the differences in treatment between someone who may have lighter skin versus darker skin, even though we still share the same ethnicity. But honestly, I don't really have too much context to apply that here in America, aside from kind of what you already got at, which was like when you were saying how you identify as Black, because when I moved to America, everyone just assumed I was Black. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's something that, you know, it doesn't like bother me, but it's something that I didn't really understand. And in fact, like I played basketball in college and a lot of my teammates were Black, and everyone since I've moved in America has just interacted with me as they would a Black man. And I remember vividly, it actually was around the same time that you wrote that article that we were talking about what it means to be biracial. And some of the guys on my team didn't even know that I was mixed. Yeah. And when I told them, I literally had to break it down by saying, do you guys understand that I am just as Black as I am white? And that was like a radical concept to them. Like the idea that you can be 50-50 of two things. So I think, yeah, bringing that back to colorism, it just might have to do with how light-skinned Black people might be treated differently than darker-skinned Black people.
Yeah. And the way I understand it, I think I wasn't exposed to this terminology and this idea of colorism until I came to the United States, especially at a college level, when I am really just surrounded by people from different backgrounds. And but the way I understand colorism, a lot of times it's more like, oh, you're treated differently if you are, you have darker skin tone.
Yeah.
And it made me think a lot about more, I guess, internationally, especially between East Asia and South Asia, just the way people view East Asians is very different than Southeast Asian, just because there's darker skin, you know. Yeah. And there's even so many products in Asia where it's like skins that make you brighter, whiter, and these are
yeah. rude,
but basically just like whiter means better. And you see that in terms of like why there's so many people in Asia, like they wear masks or they wear hats, they wear long sleeves outside because they don't want to be exposed by the sun, because they don't want to be darker. And a lot of times being darker means you're being outside too much, and being yeah. outside too much means you're not working enough. But in terms of how what this means in America, yeah, I definitely don't know as much. But I do know like just what it does mean for Asians when it comes to colorism.
Yeah, no, so colorism for our listeners who may not know, and Ben and Jack, you guys are, that, first of all, your guys' answers I think were great because you approached it from your specific cultural lens, and it is very different in an American context. So it's good to see that this concept exists all over the world, but it has different flavors and different, it shows up in different ways depending on where you're at in the world. And basically, if I'm breaking it down into the simplest terms, what colorism basically says is that the lighter you are, the better, the more virtuous you are, the more honorable, the more integrity that you have. And the darker you are, the more prone to mischievousness you are, the more prone to violence you are, the more prone to being unintelligent you are versus people that are lighter. And this theory actually comes from a lot of Greek philosophers during the early Greek and Roman times. And what's amazing and the irony of all of it is that there's a good portion of Greek philosophers that were actually studied in Alexandria, Egypt, and Africa, and actually brought teachings back to Greece, to Rome, after studying at the library in Alexandria. And so it's very ironic that they theorized this, but basically the darker you are, the more prone to violence and mischief you were, the lighter you are, the more prone to, you know, being virtuous you are. So all of that to say, in our American context, that shows up in many different ways. There's a long history of the lighter people, mulattoes, getting easier jobs on plantations and that kind of stuff, working in the house versus working in the field. There's a lot of history behind that. Post-slavery in the Jim Crow era, there are things like the brown bag test, where it was like, if you're darker than this brown paper bag, you can't come into this place. You have to go to the back of the kitchen. So where this divide actually starts and where colorism starts to really show up is in policies like this, right? There were certain benefits that mulattoes or mixed people got over people that were classified as black or people that were darker, simply because of the color of their skin. There's a really great book called Our Kind of People, and it talks about the black elites in a post-slavery world during the Jim Crow era, and how they basically were primarily light-skinned individuals and people that were of lighter descendant. We've talked about that briefly, but all of that to say, the reason why biracial discourse, for me, doesn't go very far is because in reality, the pain that you experience, the confusion around your identity, is not comparable or equivalent to those in our community who experience racism and discrimination because they are darker than us, okay? I'm gonna give you a prime example. I have a leg up when it comes to getting hired at different organizations, and the term that I've coined is light skin privilege. And it's because it's easy for any group to say, hey, this is somebody that is a minority, but also because of my appearance and because I have lighter skin, going back to this idea of colorism that is baked into our society, people would view me as a more ethical version than somebody that might be my counterpart that is darker, right? And so I think that's something, at least for me, the reason why the slam poetry like we just watched and why biracial discourse just doesn't stick for me,
yeah,
is because realistically, your pain of struggling with which box do I check on a test, and OMG, I'm too white for black people and I'm too black for white people, doesn't compare to the discrimination that people who are darker experience. I guess, Ben, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I mentioned, like, you know, the biggest, one of the biggest struggles in society from an actual, like, I guess a real constructed, objective way, literally mm-hmm. is, what box do I check when it comes down to ethnicity? And that's something that, like, is pretty easy to solve.
Yeah.
My struggle is not the same struggle as my older siblings who are black. And so I totally understand that.
Jack, any thoughts on that perspective as yeah. it relates to colorism?
No, totally agree with what you both just shared. I'm always seen as a Westerner, whether I'm in Asia. Doesn't matter if I'm half Aboriginal. A lot of times when I speak Mandarin, they're like, whoa, why can you speak Mandarin?
So really?
And I'm like, oh, I actually grew up. You know, a lot of times I let others tell me I'm Taiwanese because, you know, it's very, I don't really spend too much time thinking about it, but I know, like, a lot of times once they start getting to know me, my story, like, oh, you grew up on this, like, you grew up in Taiwan, like, you are from Taiwan, but just from, like, first look, like, I obviously look way more Western than I do Asian, but yeah, and just I guess the struggle, like, yeah, nothing comparable yeah. to, you know, people who actually face real problems or, like, right. obstacles, you know, yeah, plus, like, that's
yeah, plus, honestly, most mixed race people just code switch a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Like, when I'm in Africa, I'm always seen as the Westerner. I'm always seen as the mm-hmm. the white person, basically. And so you learn to play into that. And then when I'm over here in America, I'm always seen as a black person. And so you learn to play into that as well. So if anything, yeah. it's even easier because you aren't conformed to, like, one specific yeah. box.
Mm-hmm.
You are able to draw from multiple cultures without it being, like, some form of appropriation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one more thing, proving who you are, like, if you're American or Asian, for me, like, that's not a struggle.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a real struggle. Like, yeah, definitely. I have identity crisis, but it's not like being discriminated. It's different.
Right. Yeah, no, I that all checks out for me as well, but I would like to at some point, circle back and unpack, Jack, what you were talking about saying, like, I let other people call me Taiwanese before. Like, I would love to unpack that more. And do a deep dive on, you know, the biracial perspective from being, like, half Asian, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's something that I, like, that's a difference between how you identify and how I identify, because I think majority of my black friends, my black family interact with me as if I'm black. And it's something that I'm very proud of. And that's something that I, you know, identify with and always have. And so I don't think that I've ever thought to myself, like, I let other people, you know, mm-hmm. do that, but it's definitely interesting.
I was highly, I'm definitely gonna do it. It's a great, I think I'm always down to talk about, you know, just our different backgrounds. I think what's the major difference between me and UK is there's not a lot of mixed people that grew up in Taiwan in terms of, like,
right.
who are half American or half from another country. That's just a foreign concept for a lot of people. And then when you approach them and you speak in their own language and you understand their references, you understand who they listen to, and that sometimes can be like, whoa, like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Whereas in America, you know, there's a lot of biracial people all over the states, you know, it's become more normal. So like, that's just the way, I don't know, there's, yeah, I think that's, I would say that's the biggest difference in terms of why I sometimes let people tell me who I am, because I'm not going to tell them if I'm from Taiwan, like I'm Taiwanese, and they'll be like, no, you're not. And then I'm there proving myself versus like just being me that, oh, hold up.
Yeah, Jack, in East Africa, they have an exact term for what you're describing. And
really?
It's Muzungu plastic, which basically, so Muzungu is like in East Africa, kind of a, I wouldn't say it's a slur, but it's kind of like a slang way of referring to a white person. And then like the plastic part would basically just mean fake. So it's like, essentially you're saying like, oh, he's like a fake white person. And that's exactly what you just described is exactly the whole sentiment behind Muzungu plastic.
Crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I never even thought about like how location plays into it, Jack. So that's a really interesting point. Yeah, no, thank you guys both for, number one, sharing all of that stuff, because I know that, especially as it relates to identity, that stuff is like near and dear to our hearts. So thank you guys for sharing. Switching topics here just a little bit. Ben, one thing that I started doing like a year ago is trying to incorporate some type of multivitamin into like my daily routine. So I started with AG1 Athletic Greens. And I recently switched over to like these little, like, I don't want to call it, they're not nasty, but they don't taste that great. They're like these little cubes where it's supposed to have like all of the nutrients that you need, but in like a little chewable, like brownie. The brownie tastes horrible, but wanted to pick your brain on supplements for just a little bit here.
Yeah, totally. Supplements, something I really love talking about, just because I think this is such a lucrative. Yeah, it's
listen. Shocker. He likes talking about supplements because what y'all don't know is that we about to advertise his first supplement company on here. Okay, Okay Game Supplements. Use our code Generation Berry for 25% off.
That's hilarious. No, never will you see me start a supplement brand. But yeah, I think like, supplements are something that's so interesting because it's such a lucrative industry for something that is by definition not necessary. I pulled up the Oxford Dictionary definition of what a supplement is, and it said something that completes or enhances something else when added to it. So in the context of food supplementation, a supplement would basically just be something that completes or enhances your diet when being added to what you are already eating. So the illustration that I like to use when it comes to nutrition and supplements, and actually I use this illustration with a lot of things, you'll hear me refer to this, is that like, it's the idea of big rocks versus little rocks. So this comes from, you know, if you're trying to fill a container, you're obviously going to start with the bigger rocks to fill the container. And then you use the little rocks to fill in all the spaces in between. And that's exactly how I see supplementation. The big rocks being your real food, everything that's actually, you know, meant to be food, and the little rocks being supplements. Yeah. I think that we, because of just how industrialized we are, and here in America, how we are being marketed things as being a quick fix, it's very easy to see things the other way around. But yeah, I just think we really need to stick to supplements by their own definition, and set real food as our priority. And then everything else on top, that being supplemental. trying to fill in any gaps that are missing. And I guess one of the big filters through which I pass that thinking of, do I need this supplement, is what's the rationale? What gap is it filling in, or what benefit am I getting from this that I'm not already getting from my regular food? So a little bit of context, I eat a very well-rounded, I would consider, diet. I eat fruits, vegetables, meats, lots of different carb sources, and I generally get those from Whole Foods. So as far as my macronutrient and micronutrient intake goes, I pretty much have all the big stones in place. However, that being said, I do take supplements on a daily basis, and then there are also some that I take just on occasion. So I'll get into that real quick, and I could talk about rationale maybe another time, just to spare everyone the boredom of my nerdiness. No,
I'll ask you a question here. When, and maybe you'll talk about this here in a sec, but I was just, the first thing that just came to mind, when, you know, once you have your big stones or big rocks in place, when is a good time to start taking those, the little ones?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I would say the problem is that most people don't have those big stones in place.
Right.
I track all my food, and that can be a bit tedious. You get better at it with time, but there are all different kinds of apps that I use to make sure that I am actually getting everything that I need. But I still do take a daily multivitamin. I do take vitamin D. I take creatine. I take magnesium, ashwagandha.
Damn.
Fish oil. And of course,
this man out here clearing them out.
Listen, you would be surprised at, you know, I listed off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different supplements that I take on a daily basis. That and then caffeine. I take a lot of caffeine, I'm not gonna lie to you. You'd be surprised how many people are taking all kinds more supplements than that. And to me, what it comes down to is those supplements that I take are set in place for a reason. I have a rationale behind it. And then also, they're all super cheap. Like, I'm not taking something that puts a dent in my pocket. And that's something that I'm very intentional about, because a lot of these supplements that are seen as like, here's the one supplement that's going to solve everything that you need, it's going to have a price tag associated with its claims. Then I will occasionally, when I have like digestive issues, like if my digestion's just slow, I'll take digestive enzymes and like a fiber capsule or something like that. Mm. But that's pretty rare because, like I said, I get pretty much everything I need from my regular food.
When did you start like all of this? Like, I feel like you don't just like one day, hey, I'm going to do all these supplements. It feels like it feels like a life decision.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I think for me, what it came down to is like, as an athlete, I was always trying to look for things that would help enhance my performance. And so for a while, I was just a victim to that, like, oh, I should take more of this. I should take some of this, take some of this. And then really, it became a process of elimination as I understood more about really what is in all of your food. And now I'm just left with the things that I believe bring me a great benefit. So bodybuilding has been a big part of that. It's really exposed some of the gaps in my diet. That's like, for example, why I take a multivitamin, because although I do eat fruits and vegetables, I don't eat the greatest variety of fruits and vegetables. And that's a downfall of my diet. I eat a lot of things like broccoli, spinach, apples, that type of thing, which, you know, has everything you need, but just in small quantities. So a multivitamin is a good thing to just check off the box of knowing that those micronutrients are hit. I did want to play a game with you guys that I'm going to call Check It or Chuck It. And basically, we're just going to go rapid fire over a few different supplements that you guys have heard about, think about, and I'm going to give my perspective on whether you should check it and go ahead and use it. It has a benefit, or chuck it. It's trash. Amazing. So Jack, let's start with you.
I will throw the one that has the big longest name I can think of. Glucose disposal agent.
Yeah.
Or GDAs.
Yeah. GDAs. So overall, I'm going to go chuck it on the GDAs. What they claim to do is legit, but for most people, what it claims to do is basically have a control over your insulin sensitivity, which is very important. But for most people, they're not in a state where the big stones are in place for that to really have any kind of benefit. And like, you know, if you want your insulin sensitivity to be better, then just like eat less processed carbs and have more like real carbs. And that's like a way quicker, easier fix than having to go buy something.
I've got one here for you, Ben. What about fish oil? I know you said that you take like an omega-3, but yeah. I've heard that fish oil is absolutely a placebo.
Yeah. So as far as fish oil goes, that I don't take for any benefit that I can actually feel. That comes from, so I take an omega-3 fish oil, and that's because just from nutrition knowledge, from mostly like ancestrally as humans, we found that like the optimal ratio of the types of fats should be like a 1-to-1 between like your omega-3 fats and then omega-6 fats, which are going to be the kind of fats that are found mostly in like processed foods. And omega-3 fats are more associated with decreased inflammation, and omega-6 fats are associated with more increase in inflammation. And so, like I said, that ratio should be about 1-to-1, but it's estimated that for most people eating a Western diet, that ratio is actually closer to like 1-to-17.
Wow.
And so really, I just take the fish oil to kind of offset that ratio a little bit.
That's crazy.
Here, 1-to-17 is wild. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It makes sense why we have like gut inflammation issues and that kind of thing in America.
Well, speaking of fat, what about fat burner?
Fat burner, chuck it. Just really? Chuck it. Totally. Yeah. Garbage. I would say fat burner, the only thing that is in it that is going to truly have any benefit to you is caffeine. Like, just go drink a cup of coffee. Take caffeine pills. I take caffeine pills every once in a while. Like, there's nothing proprietary that fat burners can do for you.
What about vitamin D? So I think I was told to take one for like needing the sun and depression. I don't know if that's real or not. What about vitamin D?
Yeah, this one is one that I don't know as much how to feel about it. I will say check it, because vitamin D is super important, and most people, especially people who spend so much of their day inside, aren't getting enough of it. It's something that, like, if you do take a daily multivitamin, it's going to be in there. Mm. I take vitamin D, and I remember like during COVID times, everyone was being told like, oh yeah, get your vitamin D. And so that's kind of a habit that I've kept up since then. But yeah, really that's just because I live in Ohio and it's gray a lot. So yeah. I wish I could get more sunlight. When I was back in Africa though, you best believe I was not taking a vitamin D.
Absolutely not. Rip to my fellow Ohioans and our lack of vitamin D.
Take two. last one for me, gluttony.
Oh yeah. So
I heard about this. I've taken this before. I want to say I know what it did, but I honestly I don't know. So I was taking it without understanding what truly what it was doing. But I knew it was good.
Yeah, L-glutamine is like it's an amino acid that like supposedly should help with your digestion of different proteins. I'm gonna go chuck it. I think that if you eat real proteins, like from meat or eggs or whatever, there already is glutamine in it. And so, and in high quantities. It's not like one of those things where it's like, oh, you might just be getting trace amounts. There's a lot of glutamine if you're getting in them a right amount of protein. So more than like spending more money on getting a glutamine supplement, it won't even do anything if you're not even getting the right amount of protein anyway. And then if you are getting the right amount of protein, it's already in there. So I would just emphasize eating more protein.
That feels like a paradox.
Yeah,
in terms of like,
it is. Which is
why the fact that it's a thing is kind of crazy.
Yeah,
that is wild. Last one for me, and I know you said that you take ashwagandha. I feel like every single like bro with a podcast mic that's like, dude, what you need to do is wake up at 5 a.m. and rip 5 raw eggs, do 100 sit-ups immediately, go out into the sun, take 1,000 milligrams of ashwagandha, and then, you know, like your ancestor, like the ancestral soul will like return to you and you will be an alpha male. Like, I feel like every alpha male podcast platform encourages men to take ashwagandha. Are we checking it or are we chucking it?
Ashwagandha, I'm gonna say check it, because this is the only supplement that I've ever taken in my entire life where I've actually felt a benefit. It's not just one of those where it's like, I'm doing it because I know it's right. It's one of those where I genuinely have noticed since I put it in place that I feel better. What one of the main reasons why I take it is because it's involved in like lowering cortisol, decreasing your stress. And so I take not like a huge dose, but a pretty small dose of ashwagandha at night, kind of as I'm starting my nighttime routine, just to help me calm down. And I have noticed that my sleep has gotten a lot better. They also say that it's supposed to like raise your natural testosterone and that kind of thing. I don't know how much I believe that ashwagandha directly is responsible for that. But one thing I do know is that like if you're sleeping better and if you have generally more relaxation in your life, then your natural testosterone will be better. So it may not be like a direct effect, but I could understand the rationale. Yeah, that one, I'll say check it. It can be pricey, and I would say there are a lot of better ways to optimize those other variables. But if you are looking for something that is a supplement, by definition, a supplement, then that is a good one that I would definitely recommend. Final thoughts on this is the famous quote by Hippocrates from 400 BC, which is, "Let food be thy medicine." And I get concerned about our society that is leaning more and more towards all different kinds of medicine and drugs to solve our problems when so many of them can just be fixed by eating the right things.
Speak to us, Ben. Speak to us today. Listen, we're going to pass a collection plate around. Y'all put a couple of dollars in there for Ben ministering to us, telling us, stop eating like trash, okay? Stop it. You're killing yourself.
Yep.
Eat better.
All these things, like, I love talking about it. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, none of these things are, like, they align with my goals of bodybuilding. But, like, it's not ashwagandha that's going to make me, like, as big as, you know, John Cena or something.
Right.
And, like, yeah, I don't know. He's like 50 now and he's still huge. Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw him at the Oscars stepping out on stage naked, but
Ben, that's a great transition. I did not see John Cena on Oscar this past week. I did watch, and I kind of transition into that topic. So the 96th Academy Award or Oscar took place on March 10th in Las Vegas in Hollywood. This is the you have to know what it is, but if you don't, that's okay. This is where 23 categories, you know, Oscar kind of highlights and honors, you know, all the films that was released in 2023. And Jimmy Kimmel was the host. Usually that's like a big thing, like who's the host for the Oscar. This was his fourth time. Before I talk, go into like initial reaction, Kayla, it looks like you have something right to say. But what is your engagement like in Oscar in general, like just over the years? Like, has it been really engaging and then maybe not anymore, or like maybe you never watched it and then now you're really involved with it?
I mean, I think I've been paying attention to it for a hot second here. My perspective on it was then, speaking of John Cena, over the last couple of years, we have seen just a huge attack on the LGBTQ community, specifically being called groomers, and for just existing in different spaces, right? Like, had somebody who was LGBTQ or queer or any of that kind of stuff walked out on the stage naked, we would have been accused of grooming children and pushing a narrative. So I wholeheartedly was genuinely upset with the fact that everybody just like saw John Cena naked and was just like, yeah. Oh, like of course he's here. It's like
people were strangely cool with that.
No, exactly. Which is how you know
compare that to the Super Bowl of Jennifer Lopez.
Thank you. It's like, this is how you know people are just like anti-women and anti-gay people. Like, it's just so insane. So that's my perspective on John Cena. But I have watched the Oscars pretty religiously, probably since like 2016, since La La Land, like, really? Like won a bunch. That's when I really got into it, because I was obsessed with La La Land. And so it was really cool full circle moment seeing Emma Stone get to win her second Oscar for Best Actress. She joins a very small pool of actresses that have more than one Oscar. Like, there, I think there's literally like 10 of them or 12 of them. So it was really cool to witness. I'm a huge Emma Stone fan. I think that as an artist, she's amazing. So I love the Oscars and I love the award season.
Yeah. As far as for me, honestly, I never got super into the Oscars. I had an appreciation for these awards, and I think it's cool to recognize people for all their efforts and what they do. Right. But, you know, we went to Asbury University, which is like a huge communication arts school where media is, you know, what a lot of people talk about. And we have like crazy cinema snobs over at Asbury, and that like totally turned me off of the Oscars forever, because I feel like when it would start being Oscar season, I felt like I would just be absolutely put down by everyone for my uneducated takes on movies, when it's like, I just like what I like and I don't like what I don't like, okay? It's not that deep. And if you say that in front of anyone who is a cinema snob, then that is like heresy, which happened a lot to me at Asbury.
I enjoyed trolling film majors so much. I would say like the most out of pocket stuff that I just knew was like totally terrible. Like, I'd be like, oh my gosh, did you see the CGI in X, Y, and Z movie? It was so good, right? Like, a film that has no CGI in it. Like, I would troll them so
Caleb,
much.
You did not.
It was one of my favorite pastimes. Oh my God, I could name names here, but I won't.
Oh, I could name the names too. Probably a lot of them are the same names.
Going to the university, definitely like, hey, if you don't understand why this movie won, I'm more intelligent than you are, therefore my movie opinion is more validated. You know, just because, oh, they did work with media, they work behind the cameras, or setting up different, you know, like even boom mic, like just setting up, like planning a whole scene. Like, I feel like they definitely like understand what it takes. But that doesn't mean our the rest of the campus and what they think is not valid, if that makes sense. So definitely can relate to just, I guess Oscar has been a little bit tarnished for me as well, but I still watch it. I usually watch the last four awards, which is what I did. I watched the last Best Actor, Best Director, and then Best Actress and Best Picture. Those are what I truly care about this when it comes to Oscar. I'm not saying that the other are not important, but these are just the ones that I pay more attention to. But with that being said, I think you guys touched on something pretty curious about, like, with how movie industry is moving, especially since COVID, like movie theaters are shutting down and a lot of streaming, Netflix are making a lot of films. Everything is released really quickly after theaters. Like, what is your take about Oscar in terms of, like, does that inform you of what movie is good or not anymore? Does it inform you what movie you should pay attention to, or like, what is that the standard and whatnot, or has that, is it different?
Not in the slightest for me. I mean, I'll say it time and time again. I'm not gonna watch a movie just because it won some awards. Like, you know, shout out to Emma Stone. I love her, but I'm not gonna go watch that movie. I have zero interest in it. I don't care if it won every single award.
My respect to love in this is, I've been duped too many times. Like last year when Brendan Fraser won like Best Actor for The Whale, I went and watched The Whale afterwards. I said, now I know y'all ain't got this man out here in this fat suit like this. I know y'all ain't pressed play on this movie and gave. I was so disturbed by that movie. So I take it all with a grain of salt, because when I watched The Whale, I said, absolutely not. Whoever wrote this, I was not happy with it. But all of that to say, I do watch the Oscars. I'm very big into the award season. I think a lot of these people get it wrong a lot, if we're being honest. Like, for example, I think Killers of the Flower Moon, like the fact that Martin Scorsese has had 3 films in a row get nominated for 10 Oscars and he's taken home 0, like, I think that's pretty wild. I think, for example, the actress from Killers of the Flower Moon, was just absolutely an incredible performance. And so I think I think it was a very real reaction when Emma Stone was like thrown off that she won a second time. Like, I was very, very, very sad that Lily Gladstone, who's the actress in Killers of the Flower Moon, didn't win. She was also the first Native American to ever be nominated for that role. So, or for that, that award. So it was a huge, huge letdown.
I agree with both of you guys in terms of, does it inform what I want to watch? No, but I will say, this year, there are certain movies that definitely set the standards, like what a good movie should be, a story, like the movie Oppenheimer, you know, telling true stories, Flowers of the Moon, Killers of the Flowers of the Moon and whatnot. So I feel like that's the only thing I appreciate. Okay, like, there are titans in this industry that comes in and kind of like show, like, hey, this is what making movies is about. Like Christopher Nolan, who won 7 awards for this movie. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that happened to me that I reacted that was interesting from this weekend from the Oscar, but not enough to tell me like, hey, like Oscar is the best thing. I'm gonna keep watching my movies that I feel like is interesting to me versus like what other people tell me what is interested. But yeah, with that, any final thoughts?
I don't think I have any now.
No, I'm just excited to get off this recording so I can listen to the rest of that poem. I need something that's gonna make me laugh before I call it a night.
Oh gosh. Well, as always, y'all, thank you guys so much for joining us today. We hope that this episode
brightened your day, and that we truly appreciate the community that we're getting to build with this podcast. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to rate us 5 stars on whatever platform that you are listening to, and share this episode with your friends. Follow us on social media platforms at Generation Buried. And if there are any topics that you would like to hear about, any questions that you want to ask the podcast, anything that you want us to discuss on here, go ahead and shoot us an email or DM us at generationburied@gmail.com. We could not do this without you guys. We will see you guys next week, and we appreciate you guys listening. Y'all have a good one.